The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you very much, hearty people. Who have come out on this cold evening to meet someone from Southern California. Philadelphia is an important city to me as a young author living in Yardley, Pennsylvania. I traveled in here again and again and again so that my first book could be published by Temple University Press. And thank you. You can applaud. But it's much more importantly than that. It's an important city for Abraham Lincoln. In my biography, I take quite a bit of time to talk about that train trip of 12 days. You recall how Barack Obama reenacted the last 137 miles of it. But I think the real focal point of that trip and Lincoln's greatest expectation was to be in Philadelphia for the raising of that flag, the first time the flag had 36 stars because the Free State of Kansas was a part of the nation. And I think he was really overcome with emotion to be at Independence Hall that day. There's a kind of a grainy photograph of that experience, and this meant so much to him. I'd like to begin tonight with a question. How many of you have been to the Lincoln Memorial? Almost everyone. If I ask that question out west, not many hands go up. I want you to get in touch with the experience, maybe the first time you were there, perhaps as a young person, or maybe recently you took children or grandchildren there. The Park Service guides tell us it's still the second most visited place in Washington, second almost only to the Vietnam Memorial. You recall as you walk up those steps, you see the tall, 29-foot-high Daniel Chester French statue. As you walk into what I call that templed space, if you turn to your left, carved on one panel is the Gettysburg Address. If you turn to the right, carved in three panels, is the second inaugural address. This is very interactive. I would like several of you just to speak out, maybe here in the first rows a little easier. What was your feeling or experience? I'll repeat what you say. When you were there at the Lincoln Memorial a long time ago or perhaps recently, would anyone like to just say what it was for you to have to be there at the Lincoln Memorial? Yes.
Some of the best of what America is.
Oh, how well said. Some of the best of what America is about. Yes. Someone else. Yes, sir.
A sense of profundity.
A sense of profundity. Yes. Yes.
Inspirational.
One more person, maybe.
Awesome.
Awesome. Okay. That's what the young people say. Awesome. Well, I want to make the suggestion that however inspirational or awesome it is, that awe is not the same thing as understanding. You and I might have a great feeling in listening to the classical music of Bach or Beethoven. Doesn't necessarily mean we understand it. So I see my task as trying to take that awe, that inspiration, reverence, I've heard that word too, for Abraham Lincoln. Maybe many of us here this evening might rank him as our most important president, and to see if we can learn a little bit more about him. There is a whole lot of wonderful Lincoln books out. Many of them have a particular angle of vision. Mine, with a lot of pages, is really a comprehensive biography, far more than I ever anticipated. I spend more time on the young Lincoln. It came to me that most of us between the ages of about 18, 25, 27 are seeking to define ourselves, and this is what takes place with Abraham Lincoln. So if you will, I'd like to have three or four or five maybe snapshots of Lincoln. There's a lot more to be said, but just to kind of some windows into him. And to help us with this, everyone should have a handout. Does everyone have one? There's no one that doesn't. Because I believe and suggest that Lincoln especially, but really in a sense all of us, define ourselves by our words. He rose as a person of words. He defines who he is by words. And ultimately, he will define and redefine America. I want to just start, though, with a little problem. In our culture, there's a modern shibboleth. It's only words. If you think about it, Barack Obama was criticized by all of his Democratic opponents as, oh, he's only a great speaker. And then John McCain did the same thing. Well, just because he's a great speaker, I'm afraid words are becoming devalued in our day. We're a little cynical about great speakers. But I want to suggest that Lincoln rose as a great speaker, this man with yet less than 1 year of formal education. Amazing. So the first selection on our sheet focuses upon the largest role he occupies in his life, his politics. And I think as you and I tried to assess the candidates over the last 6 months, we, whether we were conscious of this or not, we were trying to balance what we saw as the ambition, if you will, the ego of each of them. You've got to have a lot of ego to run for political office and president. And yet we were hoping that we were finding people of integrity, character, what we sometimes say in our day, authenticity. Lincoln is barely 23 years old when he first runs for political office. He has just moved to New Salem, separated himself from his parents. He's now of adult age. And he and his friends suggest he should run for office. The way you did it was you announced your candidacy in the local newspaper. So this is what he does. It's a long announcement, 1,800 words, but I have taken out this one paragraph because my quest in my biography is to try to find the moral center of Lincoln. And I think the moral center begins with this announcement. Every man is said to have his peculiar ambition. Whether it be true or not, I can say for one that I have no other so great as that of being truly esteemed by my fellow men, by rendering myself worthy of their esteem. There's nothing wrong with having ambition, but what is the source and what is the trajectory of that ambition, Lincoln, to be esteemed by my fellow men? How far I shall succeed in gratifying this ambition is yet to be developed. I am young and unknown to many of you. I was born and have ever remained in the most humble walks of life. I have no wealthy or popular relations to recommend. So as I start the story of Lincoln, I suggest that the strong tree of his life includes this branch of ambition, and he's going to have to, in a certain sense, prune that ambition. Sometimes that ambition as a young man leaps out too far, too fast. Once at a Whig meeting in Springfield, he heard that someone was attacking the Whigs, so he rushed over to make a response. But he didn't just respond to ideas as he would do as a latter, late, older man. He saw the man who was speaking had some sort of strange, peculiar physical mannerisms. I don't know whether he was stuttering or not. And Lincoln did not simply refute his ideas. He began to imitate the man's physical mannerisms to such an extent that the man burst into tears. Humiliated, he ran out of the room. This is not the Lincoln that we think of. But I was intended to write not simply hagiography of a kind of a marble saint, but a man who had to grow. He went and found that man and apologized to him. It's fascinating to watch the way Lincoln will combine his ideas and then develop a very shrewd character in politics. Lincoln rose as a speaker. His first political speech of any note was given in 1838. The young men of Springfield formed the Young Men's Lyceum Club, and they would practice speaking and debating. And on a cold winter evening like this one, Lincoln finally received his turn. This is his first attempt. He's less than 30 years of age. I've kind of put out one particular paragraph which I think captures already this incredible ability as a speaker. How then shall we perform it? At what point shall we expect the approach of danger? Shall we expect some transatlantic military giant to step the ocean and crush us at a blow? If anybody has the book, this is in chapter 6, page 86. Never. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined, with all the treasures of the earth in their military chest, with a Bonaparte for a commander, could not by force take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. To hear the kind of evocative language. And then, At what point, then, is the approach of danger to be expected? Lincoln often liked to repeat a key idea or a key question. He took this, I think, from the Psalms as much as any other source. I answer, if it ever reaches us, it must spring up among us. The problem that he was addressing in this speech was the violence of America. 4 months before, Elijah Lovejoy, the Presbyterian editor in Alton, Illinois, had been killed by a mob for publishing an abolitionist newspaper. Lincoln was terribly upset by this. It cannot come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. It's almost eerily prophetic. We almost did die by suicide in the Civil War. In the introduction, Andy suggested that part of what I'm doing, and Jim McPherson in his kind blurb offers this also, you would be surprised at how much new Lincoln information is coming forward. It's amazing. And one of the chief treasure troves of this is a group of master's degree students under the tutelage of a professor in Illinois about 20 years ago. He said to them, there's 102 county courthouses in Illinois. I'm going to have you fan out across the state. And I think there might yet be some Lincoln legal papers in those courthouses. Lo and behold, they found hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Lincoln legal documents. Often rolled up, they'd turn blue. And most often, Lincoln's name had been razor-bladed out more than 100 years earlier. Taken now together, we have more than 5,000 Lincoln legal documents. So I decided to place a little more emphasis than previous biographies on Lincoln's legal career because we have more information. What kind of a lawyer was he? Well, I entitle one of the chapters in the biography that Lincoln says the greatest task of a lawyer is to be a peacemaker. Lincoln didn't think of himself as a prosecutor. He thought of himself as a mediator. He said to these people living in small towns in Illinois and in rural areas, settle if you can. He said, even if you win the verdict from the judge or the jury, you're still going to have to live with each other. I think they call it Philadelphia justice. But you're going to have to live with each other, so settle if you can. He said to the giant Illinois Central Railroad, which was receiving a terrible reputation as a bully in the neighborhood, don't sue these people. Even if you win, what are you going to win? You're just going to sow ill will. Settle if you can. And I suggest that these mediatorial skills became the basis by which Lincoln, as president, was able to navigate through so many contending people, the rivals appointed to his cabinet, the generals contending with each other. This lawyer became a skilled politician and then a skilled president. Another window, did Lincoln write his own speeches? Well, we're aware now that of all the speechwriters, after my first Lincoln book, I was invited to the White House, and I met Michael Gerson, the chief speechwriter. I gave a lecture, and I met not only the speechwriters, but I met all these people who were the researchers for the speechwriters. My goodness, it must have been 15 people. And President Obama, I'm sure, has the same. His chief speechwriter is 27 years old, although I think that Obama is writing more of his own speeches. I would certainly hope so, because I think he has that gift. Well, Lincoln wrote his own speeches except for one. As he took that train ride from Springfield through Philadelphia to Washington, he had in his hands the draft of his inaugural. It had gone through several revisions. I argue that Lincoln was not some spontaneous genius who could just, with a stroke of a pen, write down some wonderful words. If this was a junior high school or college audience, do I see any students out there? I would say there's no such thing as good writing. There's only good rewriting. Lincoln was a rewriter. So he showed the draft of his address to three Illinois friends. Two of them said, great, and the third one made a very significant correction. And then he came to Washington, and he met William Seward, his chief contender, rival for the Republican nomination, now his Secretary of State designate. And after going to church on that first Sunday at St. John's Episcopal Church on Lafayette Square, for whatever reason, he gave Seward a draft of his inaugural address. And he said, if you have a few minutes and would be interested, why don't you take a look at this? And if you have a few suggestions, I'd be happy to hear them. Well, that same evening, Seward's son, Frederick, arrived at Lincoln's door, rapped on the door, suite number 6 in the Willard Hotel, handed to Mr. Lincoln an envelope. I can only imagine Lincoln's thoughts when he opened the envelope. Here were 7 pages of suggestions. 49 suggestions on how to improve his inaugural address. And when he got to the end of the letter, he really must have been perplexed, because Seward said to him, your last paragraph will never do. Toss it out. Here I've written 2 new last paragraphs for you. You can choose which one you want to use. Well, if you will turn over the handout, this is a class tonight. What I thought I would show you is, on the left-hand column is Seward's last paragraph, which Lincoln adopts, but watch how Lincoln changes his words and ideas. The first sentence, Seward, I close. Lincoln, I am loath to close. Now, probably most of us know that the first rule of editing is to cut. Cut those extraneous words, cut those extra adverbs, cut those adjectives. But Lincoln extends the sentence. What's going on? Well, let me give you a better sense of this by asking us to say that sentence out loud. Lincoln always read out loud, to the consternation of his law partner, Willie Herndon. I discovered that he wrote out loud. He would speak the word, whisper the word before he put it on the paper. He had a great sense for the sound of words. So let's say together that line from Lincoln, I am loath to close. You caught it. I am loath to close. That is a technical word, assonance. It means Lincoln has placed together 2 words of similar sound. It reminds me of the story of right after the victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg. This crowd comes to the White House, serenades the president, and calls for a speech. Well, he wasn't really very good at spontaneous speaking. We're getting ready to have all kinds of wonderful events at Gettysburg as the David Wills House is being dedicated, as it's been refurnished and refurbished. Well, the night before Gettysburg, Lincoln was there in Gettysburg, and people said, speech, speech. So he gave a speech, and his young secretary, after the speech was over, wrote in his diary, that was the most forgettable speech the chief has ever offered. But the next day at Gettysburg, when Lincoln was prepared, what a masterpiece. Well, after the victory at Gettysburg at the White House, Lincoln began his impromptu remarks by saying, what was it 80-some-odd years ago that our forefathers, but 4 months later, 47 years ago, our forefathers, give Lincoln time. The second sentence is the one that Barack Obama used in his speech on November 4th, 2008 at Grant Park. Seward wrote, we are not, we must not be aliens or enemies, but fellow countrymen and brethren. Lincoln, we are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Short, succinct. Lincoln loved the Bible. He didn't call it the King James Bible. He called it the Saxon Bible. The Saxon Bible has these sturdy, one-syllable words. We'll skip the third sentence, but I just want to pause at the fourth sentence. Lincoln's reading his letter. It's page 7. He's the last paragraph, and Lincoln reads this. The mystic chords which proceeding from so many battlefields and so many patriot graves pass through all the hearts and all the hearths in this broad continent of ours will yet again harmonize in their ancient music when breathed upon by the guardian angel of the nation. My goodness sakes alive, what can I do with that? But watch what Lincoln does with that. Again, I suggest that we say it out loud together to fully appreciate the music of this final sentence of Lincoln's first inaugural address. Let's say it slowly. You and I speak 150 words a minute. Lincoln speaks only 110 words a minute so that he could be understood often in outdoor settings. The mystic chords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. We wouldn't be repeating William Seward's words tonight, but Lincoln took Seward's ideas and transformed them into what I would call prose poetry or poetry. One of the modern questions coming forward, and I wrote my book as much for the non-Lincoln person and trying to, if I can, reach out to the younger generation, is the question, did Lincoln really believe in the abolition of slavery, or was it merely a military maneuver when he signed the Emancipation Proclamation? Let me make the question even starker. In the last 25 years, Lincoln has been accused as being a racist. And what did he really think? And then the modern question that we'll also get to, well, how does one combine religion and politics? In the second inaugural address, Lincoln mentions God 14 times, quotes the Bible 4 times, invokes prayer 3 times. How could a man who never joined a church use such religious language? What's going on here? Let me start back with the Emancipation Proclamation. Issued on January 1st, 1863, a provision in it offered the possibility that blacks could serve in the military. This deeply angered the Union Army. Almost all of them said, we did not sign up to free African Americans or Negroes, as they would have said. We signed up to save the Union. Most people, including Lincoln, believed that probably blacks could not fight, that they had been almost cowed into docility or passivity on the plantations where they served. 90% of the blacks in the Union Army came from the South. They didn't come from the North. But Secretary of War Stanton and some of the generals began to push this idea forward, and Lincoln watched. This is the beauty of Lincoln. He could change his mind. He grew from experience. He grew from other people's ideas, and slowly he became a defender of this. In the middle of 1863, he was invited to return to Springfield. Oh, how he wanted to go. The largest Union rally of the war, 50,000 people gathered in Springfield on the first Saturday of September. Oh, he desperately wanted to go. He couldn't go. It took too long. So he sent a letter to be read. It's 7 speaking stands. You can't speak to 50,000 people without a microphone. But there were 7 speaking stands by which the letter was read. And Lincoln always wanted to speak to his opponents. This whole idea of rallying the base, Republicans speak to Republicans today, Democrats speak to Democrats. Lincoln wanted to speak to people who disagreed with him. He thought that he could persuade them by his speech. So he said at the outset, I know that you don't agree with the Emancipation Proclamation and you don't like me because I issued it. And then towards the end of his address, he offered these amazing words. It's just the next selection. Peace does not appear so distant as it did. I hope it will come soon and come to stay, and so come as to be worth the keeping in all future time. It will then have been proved that among free men there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet. Oh, he loved alliteration. And that they who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. But then this is what leaped out of his remarks. And then there will be some black men who can remember that with silent tongue and clenched teeth and steady eye and well-poised bayonet, they have helped mankind onto this great consummation. Lincoln decided he would defend the courage of the black soldiers, come what may. Well, if he'd have stopped there with that affirmation, that would have been startling enough. But he didn't stop. His sentences often had a semicolon in them. The last part of the sentence is more startling yet. And while I fear there will be some white ones unable to forget that with malignant heart and deceitful speech, they have strove to hinder it. He was talking to the very people with whom he had lived for 24 years, and he knew what was in many of their hearts. Well, this became a huge campaign document. in the re-election campaign of 1864. It's almost forgotten today. I bring it out because I think it says so much about the evolution of Lincoln's thought and what he really thought about African Americans and the courage of black soldiers. And one more window. The conventional wisdom is that Lincoln was not a religious person. After all, he's the only president, I think, who never joined a church. Now, those who deal with Lincoln have to come to terms with the fact that the second inaugural address has this amazing religious language in it, but it's usually kind of cast aside in a couple of different ways. When I'm asked a question about it, I'm usually lectured by it, by people in the audience. A congressman in Washington didn't ask me. He told me. I later learned he was formerly a professor at Duke. Well, what makes you think that Lincoln is at all religious? He's simply using the Bible, or he's using Shakespeare the way any cultured person would do so in the middle of the 19th century. And besides, we know from today, which is fair enough, that many politicians use religious language as a shrewd political maneuver because our nation is a largely religious nation. Well, that's a fair question. It really is. How do we know what Lincoln really thought? Well, central to my whole biography is my picture for you of the way Lincoln defined his thinking. Again and again and again and again, he'd take little scraps of paper, sometimes the back of a flap of envelope, and he'd sketch out an idea. Sometimes he dated it, sometimes he did not. Slavery. On what basis can one person say that they will hold another person in slavery? And then Lincoln, the lawyer, would almost walk. Stepped off there. I'm okay. One, he would step around all the corners of the question. Well, let's see. Is it because the first person has more intellect than the second? Or is it because the first person has greater economic standing than the second? Or is it because the first person is of a different color than the second? And on and on and on. And at the end of the note, I can't think of a single reason why one person could hold another in slavery. In 1856, for his eyes only, as Lincoln was in the doldrums, he had lost election for the Senate in January of 1855. His career seemed to be going nowhere. He sketches a note for his eyes only, Stephen Douglas, and he charts the amazing career of his adversary, Chief Stephen Douglas, almost candidate for president in 1856. And at the end of the note, Lincoln says, "My life is nothing but a flat failure. My life is nothing but a flat failure." The most remarkable slip of paper, I think, is one that is now at Brown University. It's undated. I traveled there to see it, to hold it in my hand. I put a question mark after the date. Some people say 1862, others say 1864. It was found after Lincoln's death, tucked in a drawer at the bottom of his desk. His young secretary, John Hay, found it. It answers the question of the authenticity of Lincoln's religious belief. It's the last selection. Let's just take a moment looking at it. Lincoln writes, "For his eyes only, the will of God prevails. In great contests, each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God. Both may be and one must be wrong." Lincoln likes to underline key ideas, even though he never thought any of us would ever see this. "God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time." And then this profound sentence, "In the present civil war, it is quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party." Lincoln had become so tired of delegations of ministers and politicians coming to him to say, "God is on our side, God is on our side," as they came to Jefferson Davis, "God is on our side." Lincoln suggests that maybe God's purpose is different from the purpose of either party, and yet the human instrumentalities working just as they do are of the best adaptation to affect his purpose. I recently was in New England. It's the old Puritan who says, "Praise the Lord," and pass the ammunition. Lincoln then says, "I am almost ready to say this is probably true, that God wills this contest and wills that it shall not end yet." One of the prisms through which I ask you to understand Abraham Lincoln is that he was comfortable with ambiguity. Ambiguity has become a bad word in our time. Oh, you're a flip-flopper. Can't you make up your mind? In Lincoln's day, you had the abolitionists on the left, absolutely convinced of their truth. The secessionists on the right, absolutely convinced of their truth. I'm afraid in our society we have those on the left and those on the right who shout, 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 even on television and radio talk shows. And most of us in the moderate center are rather mute about our ideas. Let me sense the way this could be read. I am almost ready to say this is probably true that God wills this contest. That sounds like an affirmation, doesn't it? But let me read it a second way. I am almost ready to say this is probably true. Why do we think that Abraham Lincoln embodies, as the first person said here, the woman here in the second row? Because of his marvelous humility. Even in the second inaugural address, the Almighty has his own purposes, but Lincoln is not saying, and I'm arrogant enough that I know what those purposes are. Lincoln is on a profound religious journey. It is not that we can define every aspect of his faith, but he's engaging the question of religion and politics at a deep level. I conclude with this. Lincoln was a man of precedent. As a lawyer, he was steeped in precedent. As a politician, he brought out a document that had been totally forgotten. This may be hard for you to believe. Maybe we can get into this in the question and answer, the Declaration of Independence. It was viewed in Lincoln's time only as a document that separated the United States from the mother country, England. Lincoln brings it back into play as a reforming document. All men are created equal, and we're going to make that more true in our time. But then at the end of 1862, Lincoln shifts from the past and does what I call begins to think in the future tense. And I conclude with his words, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate for the stormy present. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew." Why are we still interested in Abraham Lincoln in 2009? Because he has wisdom for today. He can't tell us what to do about climate change. He's not going to help us with stem cell research. But he is saying to us, every generation must redefine America for its time. We're facing a whole new set of problems. And as Barack Obama has discovered in quite a almost marvelous way, this man from the 19th century for Obama, and I suggest for us, can become a model, if not a mentor, as we face the questions of our own day. Thank you very much. Now we're going to have our questions and answers, and I am told that you are to come forward, use the microphone. I will recognize you when you use the microphone, and everybody will hear the comment and the question. Okay? Just come on forward if you have something to say, or we'll... Here we come. Do you come to him, or does he come to you? Okay, great.
I really appreciated your analysis, particularly of that last passage. Coincidentally, I was involved in a discussion with a group. It was a Great Books sponsored group on the second inaugural address. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions we played around with was, in his speech, this second inaugural address, it didn't seem clear to any of us who Lincoln was basically blaming for the war. Was he blaming the segregationists? Was he blaming the North in part, the secessionists? Or was he blaming God?
A wonderful question. You heard the question, so I don't have to repeat it. I think the genius of the second inaugural is, first of all, and I'm answering your question, is Lincoln is very inclusive. When Lincoln gets to the central part of that address, where he is, in a sense, saying to the American people, there is a great evil in our midst. We don't usually say that in inaugural addresses. If he would have said, and that American offense is slavery, well, the crowd would have erupted in cheers because they assumed he was talking about Southern slavery. But when he says American slavery, first of all, he's saying we are all responsible. That's Lincoln's inclusivity. He recognizes that if the South alone is meant to bear the blame for the Civil War, they will never be able to come back into this Union. He is also suggesting, and maybe this is hard for modern ears to hear, he's sounding like a Puritan preacher with a Jeremiah, God has a complaint against us, and the complaint is slavery, and God is judging the United States. And therefore, what had happened with the lash, those are his words, 400 years of slavery, must now be paid for, 300 years of slavery, 200 years of slavery, 250 years, must now be paid for by the death of 620,000 men. This is a moral universe. So I don't think he's blaming God, but he's saying God, in a sense, is blaming us. God is a just God. We can talk more about that, but I think that's what he's saying. Yeah. Yes?
You had made reference to Lincoln qua lawyer.
Yes.
Based on my reading of Lincoln history, we'll call it, mm-hmm. It seems that his first big imprint or, let's say, impression in the East was as a result of his speech at Cooper Union.
Yes.
In early 1860, in which he gave a very, let's say, great legal argument as to the constitutionality of secession, etc. My great-grandfather's brother was born in upstate New York in October of 1858, and he was named by his Quaker parents Abraham Lincoln Thorne. And I was wondering whether you had any thoughts as to why Lincoln had made such an impression that early in the game in the East.
A wonderful question. Lincoln had achieved a national reputation of sort for his debates with Stephen Douglas of 1858, and the perception was that this Western frontier man was a good debater. Then he was invited to speak in New York City. Originally, the invitation was to Henry Ward Beecher's church at Plymouth Congregational in Brooklyn, but the event was shifted to Cooper Union in Manhattan. Lincoln arrived for that event not ready to speak spontaneously, but he had really worked hard on this. And his basic argument was, let's follow out how the men who were a part of the Constitutional Convention, who admittedly had passed on slavery as a way of getting all 13 colonies in, how did they vote in the next 20 to 25 years whenever the issue came forward, such as the Northwest Ordinance, which outlawed slavery in the Northwest Territories. And he showed by a very ingenious and systematic historical research that again and again and again, whenever they had a chance to vote on slavery, they voted against it. So here was the New York intellectual and business elite sitting here, not too sure what this young Western man was going to say. They were astounded. Harold Holzer, in his wonderful book about Lincoln at Cooper Union, suggests, and it was said at the time, that perhaps this is the speech that made Lincoln president. It certainly was the speech for people in the East who suddenly took a different look at this man and recognized that he was a man of intellectual substance. So it was a terribly important event. We didn't mean to silence you. Any other comments or questions? Here's this gentleman right here.
Do you have the sense, sir, that Lincoln was at all conflicted between the ideals of the Declaration of Independence and the legal principles that formed the Constitution?
Wonderful question. He was conflicted, and scholars struggle with this. The Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal. The Constitution, in a certain sense, passes on that. So, in a sense, the Constitution is the more conservative document. The Declaration is the more radical or liberal document. I suggested that the Declaration was gathering dust. The Whig leaders, Rufus Choate of New York, said it has nothing to do with us, he said in the 1830s. John C. Calhoun of South Carolina trashed the Declaration of Independence in the Senate. He said it's absolutely nonsense to think that all men are created equal. Stephen Douglas, in the debates with Lincoln, said, well, of course Jefferson didn't mean black men. He obviously meant white British citizens. So in the debate where Lincoln is usually misquoted, Lincoln at Charleston in the fourth debate says, now, it's not that I'm about to marry a black woman. That would not have been thinkable in the middle of the 19th century. It's not that I think that blacks should serve on juries. It's not that I think, but that's the debater's tactic, the lawyer's tactic. You concede what you can to make the larger point, And then he turns and he says, but this black woman, in her right to earn the bread which she has from her own hands, is every bit the right of any person, including every one of you here, because all men are created equal. Now, then Lincoln had to conface the sense, but the obviously at the time that Jefferson offered that declaration, all people weren't equal. So Lincoln again uses an interesting religious analogy. He said, well, when Jesus said, be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, he didn't mean that we are perfect. He was suggesting this is the direction towards which we should strive. That's what the founders meant. They knew that everyone wasn't equal. It's the direction towards which we should strive. So in our time, we're going to make people more equal. And Lincoln even says, and in the future time, it may be that people will become more equal yet. So what he does with the Declaration is make it a reforming document, not simply an historical signpost. And that is really quite surprising in his day. Here's a couple questions.
Yes. Thank you very much. You often hear or read about Lincoln's depression.
Yes.
And in fact, his suicidal tendencies at different points in his life. Could you comment on how you feel that impacted him in terms of his position on slavery and his position on being able to free some of the men that were supposed to be executed because of desertion and different things like that?
That's a fascinating question. Lincoln was Joshua Schenck in his fine book, Lincoln's Melancholy, suggests that we, those of us who are afflicted with mental illness, we might respond in various ways. He suggests that it makes Lincoln more empathetic to people who struggle. And therefore, Lincoln drove his generals crazy when on Friday, what he called Butcher's Day, he was presented with all these documents that he had to put this man to death because he fell asleep as a sentry, and he had to put this man to death. Once he got a document of a man who not only had done bad things in the military, but he had stood on a stool in a transom and looked over to see a woman in an undressed position in a hotel room, he was to be court-martialed and put to death. But this was Stephen Douglas's sister's son. And he said, I think this would be a terrible waste. He said, I think this man is much better above ground than underground. And this man, reprieved by Lincoln, went on to become the only person in the history of the United States military to be a three-time winner of the Medal of Honor. And so Lincoln's record of kind of freeing people, maybe he was too benevolent, but this is what he believed. And if it came out of his own personal struggle, perhaps I hadn't quite thought about it that way, but that may be true. Here and there.
Thank you very much. We're reading the handout that you gave tonight, especially the last piece where Lincoln really talks about God, and then in his second inaugural where he really talks about God. Do you think it's because by that time of the war, the combination of the carnage that was going on and the amounts of deaths that were going on, and also the death of his son, that made Lincoln question just what it meant in life and why all this was happening?
I think so. I can't speak for all of you, but I think for many of us, we push against our parents, which might be our parents' religion when we are young. We go on our own way. Lincoln becomes a scoffer and skeptic. But then when tragedy begins to strike us in our 40s and 50s, we may take a look at the fresh look at the meaning of life. Lincoln's got he now begins to appropriate religious faith, but it can't be the faith of his parents. That faith is too narrow. It's too emotional. He's got to find a faith that's more logical and reasonable, and that's why I think he finds in the old school Presbyterian minister in Springfield, and especially in Washington, a faith where he can ask questions, that this is logical. He can respect the intellect of the minister. But I do think it's the death of Willie in 1862 and the death of all these soldiers that forces Lincoln to kind of come to a new understanding of the ultimate realities in life. Here's right here in the front row.
Thank you for your wonderful talk. Appreciating it. We all have heard that Barack Obama has taken some of the ideas of the Team of Rivals. Mm-hmm. And we are in the middle of reading that. We'll read yours, too. but I'm curious as to how you feel. Someone, an analyst or a journalist said that Lincoln's Team of Rivals really wasn't a good idea at all, and it really caused a great deal of difficulty. So I wanted your take on that, also to reflect perhaps on the present.
Right. Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin has lifted up this Team of Rivals, the idea that Lincoln appointed to his cabinet his chief Republican rivals. He also brought in Democrats to his cabinet. But Matthew Pinsker, who also teaches here in Pennsylvania, has challenged that idea in an op-ed piece and pointed out that they often didn't operate as a team, that Salmon Chase was still criticizing Lincoln behind his back, that Cameron from Pennsylvania, Lincoln fired him after 12 months. I don't think that takes away from Lincoln's basic idea. And I think what it says about Lincoln is that he is this strong person who is not afraid of other strong people and of people who have conflicting ideas. I think I at first was a little wondering about Barack Obama because it's become pretty conventional for politicians of both parties to try to wrap the mantle of Lincoln around themselves, maybe even to say to a speechwriter, get me a Lincoln quote for my next speech. But if you read The Audacity of Hope, I think there's something very genuine here. I think Obama finds in Lincoln a model. And the symbolism, obviously, of choosing that Lincoln Bible, which had never been used since that time, of reenacting the train ride, of choosing the new birth of freedom. Obama's not saying I'm as great as Lincoln, but I think he's trying to be inclusive as Lincoln is. There's a kind of authenticity that people have sensed in Obama as he campaigned for the office. He has the gift of oratory, so I think he's looking to Lincoln as a guide. But I wouldn't push it all the way. I mean, obviously, Obama's a man of great education, you know, Harvard Law School compared to Lincoln. But they're both from Illinois, and their chief opponent were both the senator from New York.
I have a question. If John Wilkes Booth had failed in its attempt to assassinate President Lincoln, how different would the country have been with Lincoln as a continue on with his presidency, and what accomplishments do you think he would have done in the Reconstruction that we sort of lost with Andrew Johnson?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? First of all, it's important to know that Lincoln only lived 41 days after his second inaugural address, but that at that second inaugural, gamblers in the street were betting that Lincoln would be elected for a third term and would serve all the way to March 1873. If he had chosen, there was no term limits. Lincoln had now won the respect of the country. He had pointed to his second cabinet, not all of these rivals, but fine persons who were much more loyal to him, who would have operated much more as a team than the first cabinet. If anyone, Lincoln could combine that conciliatory attitude towards the South and that strength. Lincoln's greatest opponents were the members of his own party, the radical Republicans, because he wanted to bring the South in on what they thought were far too soft terms, 10% of the population initially coming in. And what happened after Lincoln's death was the members of his own party, the radical Republicans, decided they were going to punish the South. So I've begun for the first time ever to begin to speak in the South, the first 7 or 8 years of writing about Lincoln, no invitations from the South. And I think I can't even speak about the South, but the 100 years or more that followed Lincoln might have been quite different. And now people in the South, I think, are taking a whole fresh look at Lincoln with great appreciation. Over here or here, whatever.
You didn't say anything about his marriage.
I do in the book.
Okay. Could you address how the two of them
say that
got
again?
Along? Could you address how the two of them got along?
Yes. I take a little bit more of a benign or positive attitude towards Mary Todd Lincoln. Some are pretty tough on her. She was as a girl, most girls of her time only received 4 or 5 years of education. That was it. Her father believed in education for girls as well as boys. She was a very well-educated young woman, spoke French, and her sisters, all of them didn't want her to marry Abraham Lincoln because she was marrying beneath herself. She was his partner intellectually. She was quite an adept politician in a time when women were not supposed to be involved in politics. I think they had an intellectual relationship as well as a romantic relationship. She was a person of a lot of difficulty. She was a person with a short temper. Lots of people didn't like her because she could really lash out, I suppose. And sometimes Lincoln just left when that began to happen and went to his law office. I don't think Lincoln necessarily receives high marks through all of this. When she was going through great difficulty, the death of her children, I think Lincoln wasn't always present to her. So I don't think that she should share the blame. I think that that's one place where Lincoln might have been a better husband, been more present to her. When they get to the White House, then I'm afraid things begin to unravel for her. She no longer is his political confidant. The members of his cabinet take first place. He's totally absorbed. He's now commander-in-chief. We haven't even talked about that. When Willie Lincoln dies in February of 1862, her whole life collapses, never to be put back together again. But I have more empathy for her. I mean, I don't write about what happens in the 1870s and 1880s. There's a whole new treasure trove of letters that was found 5 years ago at Hildeen, Robert Todd Lincoln's home in Vermont, the so-called insane asylum letters, which cast a whole different light that Robert Todd Lincoln was not out to hurt his mother. He was out to try to help his mother. And he's cast that shadow on himself. So, and I talk about the boys in here and the marriage relationship. Sadly, I think she burned most of the letters between the two of them. This was their personal relationship. So we don't really have the letters to tell us very much about their relationship. We wish we did. This was not a surprising thing in the 19th century that persons would burn the letters so that no one would be able to tell what happened between the two of them.
Can you tell us how he viewed his some of the more prominent generals during the war?
Here again, I was privileged to read Jim McPherson's Tried by War in its manuscript form, and what came through to me was that when I looked at the traditional Lincoln biographies, that they didn't say enough about Lincoln being commander-in-chief. He really, in a sense, invented that title and office. It's very ill-defined in the Constitution. So I found myself, to great surprise, talking far more about this than I intended. I'd never even ventured into trying to describe military battles or anything like this. So I show the different ways, the father-son way, the affirmation way. I argue that Lincoln begins with deference and respect. Old Winfield Scott, fuss and feathers, 350 pounds, 74 years old, and young George McClellan, 34 years old, little Napoleon. And one of the reviewers that will be in the Washington Post on Sunday say, I don't really say why Lincoln didn't fire McClellan sooner. Lincoln moves slowly. But his relationships with his generals is quite remarkable. The most remarkable relationship is with Ulysses S. Grant, who he deeply respects. When the word finally comes that victory has come at Vicksburg, Lincoln writes a letter to Grant that's just amazing. He says, "Dear General Grant, when you decided to go into Mississippi, I thought you were wrong. When you took your time mounting a siege, I was convinced you were incorrect. When you did this, I was totally in a disagreement with the policy that you took," and on and on and on. And he simply concludes, "General Grant, I was wrong. And you were right. Yours, Abraham Lincoln." What does that tell us about Abraham Lincoln? It's just amazing that someone would write a letter like that. How are we doing on our time?
5 minutes,
okay. Someone else? Here we are.
Thank you. I'd like to ask if Lincoln's opposition to the Mexican-American War had any impact on his role as commander-in-chief during the Civil War?
Very good question. When Lincoln came to Washington at the end of 1847 to serve his only term in Congress, the war with Mexico, as most American wars, was quite popular. But Lincoln and other Whigs were deeply troubled. Lincoln did some research on it, and then he spoke out against it. And he challenged the President of the United States, James Polk, by saying, on what spot did the Mexicans actually commit aggression against us? And ever after, Lincoln received the epithet, as it were, Spotty Lincoln. And then Lincoln tried to advance this policy, difficult at any time. I am against the policy of the war with Mexico because it is an expansionist war fed by Southerners who want to extend slavery below the border. But I am for the troops. That's a tough one to pull off, as we've witnessed recently. So Lincoln serves his one term, which was part of a rotation system, but he comes home to Illinois very unpopular. However, when he becomes president, he's sitting in a different chair. And Andrew Jackson, who he and fellow Whigs had called King Andrew for his autocratic tendencies when Jackson was president, now sits in Lincoln's office in an oil painting. And Jackson, the Democrat, suddenly achieves a new kind of respect from Lincoln because Jackson had stood up in the nullification crisis of 1832. So Lincoln then becomes accused of the very thing that Polk and Jackson were accused of, operating as a dictator, of accruing too much power for the presidency. He was conscious of that, but again, he felt that the times meant that there had to be a strong presidency. He's still criticized for that today in some circles. Any other comment or question? Thank you very much. I really appreciate being with you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.